Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left.
Those words still echo in the ears of Americans who understand just how they were heard by some of the most dangerous and partisan extremists in our nation. They also only escalate further our concerns about what our society is likely to face after the election, regardless of the outcome. For an expert look at that kind of language, as well as what's probably already in place, I'm joined by Helio Fred Garcia, author of the book Words on Fire: The Power of Incendiary Language and How to Confront It. So, Fred, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Elton. Delighted to be back.
So, who would you expect to hear those words, stand down and stand by, from the President of the United States as directed at them?
Well, one of the things that I do in Words on Fire, Welton, as you know, is I describe what I call Trump's dance with white supremacists. And it follows a predictable pattern. And that is, he signals to them and they signal back. And in particular, when he is asked to denounce white supremacists, he follows another pattern. And that is a four-step process. The first is to deflect the request to denounce white supremacists. When pressed, the second is to diminish the significance of the white supremacists. The third is, in a tone of voice that suggests he doesn't really mean it, to speak some language of criticism or condemnation. But the fourth is to resume the prior language. We saw precisely that after Charlottesville. And when he said good people on both sides, David Duke sent a thank you tweet, and the Daily Stormer sent a note to its neo-Nazi followers saying he loves us, invited to denounce us, he declined to do that. He did the same thing after the New Zealand shooter when he was asked at an event to denounce white supremacists. He followed the same pattern. He did the same thing after El Paso. And we saw him do it when he was invited to denounce the Proud Boys. And he began by deflecting, I don't know who they are. What do you want me to say? Then he diminished and said, look, there's lots of blame to go around. It's also Antifa and the far left. The next day, he did the tepid denunciation. He said, I don't know who they are, but they should follow the law. And then he was right back using divisive language. That is a pattern. It is not surprising that within an hour, the Proud Boys had taken stand by and stand back and put it on their logo and started selling merchandise with it. It is precisely that dance that we have seen, whether it's with the Daily Stormer, the neo-Nazi group, or with David Duke, or with Richard Spencer, or with QAnon. We see the same pattern, and it is profoundly dangerous.
Yeah. Fred, it was 2016 that Donald Trump cryptically referred to, quote, Second Amendment people doing something about judicial appointments a president, Hillary Clinton, might make. Later, he's made repeated and unforgettable references to his supporters having most of the firearms, claiming he has the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump. Things were not as tense in America when he said those things then. But what do we need to honestly consider as possible as we sit here today?
Welton, one of the patterns that I point to is, as Trump gets more and more desperate, and as he feels more and more that he is being put upon in a time frame that is difficult, say an election, he escalates his rhetoric to create an invented crisis that calls for some kind of armed response. Now, when he was a candidate in 2016, he didn't really have that power. But we saw a preview of what can happen in the next few months back in June and July. And that is during the Black Lives Matters protest, when some people who were not Black Lives Matters protesters began to commit acts of violence against property and against people, the president exaggerated the risk and he called for the mobilization of the active duty military. He even called up the 82nd Airborne, who arrived in Virginia and Maryland with automatic weapons with fixed bayonets. His Secretary of Defense, on a conference call with the president and with mayors and governors, talked about, we, the military, will dominate the battle space that is American cities. And that was too much for retired Defense Secretary James Mattis. And General Mattis took to The Atlantic and The Atlantic magazine, and he denounced first Secretary Esper and then President Trump. He said of Secretary Esper, "Secretary, it is completely inappropriate for you to be using the language of battle space to be nominated when you're talking about American cities. That is dangerous, it is unconstitutional, and I'm calling you out on it. You can't do that." Then he turned to the president and said, "Mr. President, my entire time in your cabinet, I never once heard you use language to unite, only to divide. What you're proposing is both unconstitutional and dangerous, and you need to stop." General Mattis was modeling what engaged citizens and civic leaders and public figures need to do. Now, the president dropped his idea of mobilizing the active duty military, but then he mobilized fatigue uniformed, non-insignia wearing troops who turned out to be Department of Homeland Security police, but without any insignia as to who they were individually or which units they were with. They began rounding people up in Portland and putting them in civilian vehicles, the kinds of things you see in a police state. And when he finally couldn't get away with that, he dropped it. I worry about his using the instruments of power in the aftermath of an election that he purports to have been illegitimate. And I'm worried that some elements of the U.S. government might go along with him, especially those under the command of the Department of Justice, ATF, folks like that, or under the command of the Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol, ICE. I am pretty confident that the U.S. uniformed military will refuse an unlawful order or the invocation of the Insurrection Act, but I'm less confident about people who report up to Bill Barr or people who report up to the Department of Homeland Security acting secretary.
Are these irresponsible statements more likely to activate organized militias and far-right groups, or do they serve as the kinds of lone wolf whistles that you write about in your book?
What incendiary language, the language of dehumanization of groups, the language of demonizing of rivals, the creation of a fake crisis calling on citizens to take action to protect the nation, all of that is right out of not only the authoritarian playbook, but out of the lone wolf whistle playbook that I describe in Words on Fire. And that is language that creates social conditions that inspire some people to take up arms and to commit acts of violence. Now, the phrase organized militia that you used in your question is an interesting one, because militia typically is intended to mean some unit of government. But here, private citizens have taken on the label militia. They call themselves militia. What they really are is armed gangs, and they don't have any command and control. And in that sense, they really are lone wolves. In this instance, they are lone wolf packs that are operating collectively but without command and control, but rather they've been inspired by signals, which I call lone wolf whistles, from, in this instance, their hero, the charismatic leader in charge. Whether it is private citizens acting solo, the typical lone wolf, or the so-called militias acting collectively, which we might call the lone wolf pack, both of those are dangerous because both of those see that they have been given permission by the president to take up arms. We saw precisely that in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in the case of the individual lone wolf who happened to be a teenager, But his mother took him across state lines with semi-automatic weapons in violation of every conceivable kind of firearm law. So that isn't even in alignment with the Second Amendment, because even the Second Amendment says there are rules about where you can take guns and who can carry guns, and a 17-year-old cannot.
Fred, what do you foresee for our nation in the weeks after November 3rd? And is there even a realistic way we could prepare for that kind of scenario?
One of the things that will make violence in the streets less likely, in my opinion, is an overwhelming, clear victory by Biden. The closer it is, the more the president can assert that it was rigged, it was fixed. He has been using the false narrative, as you know, of talking about mail-in ballots as capable of fraud. He's talking about universal ballots. He is suing states to prevent them from sending not ballots, but ballot applications. But he conflates the ballot application with the ballot. And he's building a public context in which he can challenge the legitimacy of the election. The bigger the gap between Biden and Trump, the less likely he can get away with it. But the other thing that can happen is exactly what you and I are doing now, that we've seen Rachel Maddow do on MSNBC and others in positions of influence, and that is to name this as the pattern and to call this out as the risk and to begin to equip citizens to anticipate this happening so that they can act quickly if it should happen, to say that's too far, you can't do that. We've already seen leaders in the military begin behind the scenes to say, I will not allow my troops to follow an unlawful order. We will stand down if we have to. And that's an encouraging sign. Again, I worry about those elements of the government that are not professional military, but that are controlled by Attorney General Barr or by the Department of Homeland Security. But at this point, it is awareness raising and equipping citizens the way you are doing on this program today to anticipate that this is a possibility, if not a likelihood, and to have the capacity to respond quickly to say, you cannot do that. We will not allow you to get away with it.
Fred, you recently wrote a powerful article headlined "The Consequences of Misinformation, Trump, Largest Disseminator of False COVID-19 Information." And that was before the outbreak in the White House. Please talk about the pandemic of untruth, if you would.
Well, as you know, one of the hats I wear is I'm a professor of both ethics and leadership and also of communication at both New York University and Columbia University. And I take seriously the need for civic leaders to speak the truth. And one of the stories that got lost was a very, very detailed and deep report by the Cornell University Alliance for Science. And it was published Thursday afternoon, less than 48 hours after the Proud Boys reference at the debate, but about 5 hours before President Trump announced that he was positive for COVID. And as a result, that report from Cornell was essentially lost in the news cycle. It looked at more than 3.5 million pieces of English language content between January and the end of May of 2020. And it identified in particular 1.1 million news stories that had misinformation about COVID-19. And it did an analysis of the kinds of misinformation there. And it reached a conclusion that 37% of the news stories had a statement that was false about COVID-19 attributed to the President of the United States. So 380,000 stories in English language news media attributing to the President of the United States false information about COVID-19. The Cornell study further concluded that it was likely that more than 50% of those stories actually had misinformation that was traceable to the president, but there were many, many stories that had the same misinformation as had been attributed to the president, just without the president's name. So somebody else would take what the president said and then repeat it. They categorize the misinformation, the most common, and again, this is between January and the end of May, the most common, with nearly 300,000 stories, were stories about miracle cures, about hydroxychloroquine, about injecting disinfectants into your body. Now, that's even before the stories we've seen in the fall about this vaccine that is right around the corner, that you and I both know is not right around the corner. But what is troubling is the second most common form of misinformation, more than 50,000 stories, was attributing the COVID-19 phenomenon to the so-called deep state. And the conspiracy that said there really isn't a COVID-19, it's really a deep state conspiracy to embarrass President Trump. The third most common was 40,000 stories that attributed COVID-19 as being a Democratic Party hoax. Now, there are meaningful consequences of this. Dr. Erwin Redlener, the director of the Center for Pandemic Resource and Response at Columbia University, has done a statistical analysis and has concluded that if we had gone to a national masking policy in March, if we had gone to a national work from home policy in March, if we had had consistent masking and social distancing in the United States, fully 150,000 of the more than 210,000 people who have died would not have died. And that is a tragic consequence of misinformation.
Fred, you have a long and successful history in crisis communications, and I can't have you on here today and not ask you, what were your thoughts as you watched the Harris-Pence debate this week?
Well, we learned a week ago the need for someone to be able to turn off a microphone. And although he did it in a less brutal manner, Vice President Pence behaved similarly to the president from a week ago. And that is, even though he had run out of time and even though the moderator signaled to him two, three, four times, he continued to speak over the moderator, Susan Page, and he continued to speak over Senator Kamala Harris. She, to her credit, would simply look at him and smile and say, "Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking." I believe that he was attempting to get her to become angry, and she instead kept her cool. And I think the vice president came out on the wrong side of public opinion on that debate.
Yeah. In these crucial last weeks before Election Day, what should citizens who want to be informed and prepared be focusing on?
They should be focusing on the gap between what the president says and what science and observation prove to be true. And the president says that there's rioting in the streets. Don't believe it. Look for yourself. When the president says that there is fraud in the elections, don't believe it. Look for yourself. Find people who were considered experts before the president was in office. Look to the reliable sources. Don't depend upon someone who is the leading proponent of misinformation about both COVID and about civic life.
Fred Garcia is a professor of ethics, leadership, and communication at Columbia University and New York University, the founder of Logos Consulting Group. Fred is former chair of the board of Interfaith Alliance. This summer, he published his latest book, Words on Fire, The Power of Incendiary Language and How to Confront It. Fred, thank you for sharing your insights with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Elton.